I'm a pediatric radiologist. You didn't know that, do you? You thought I was the thorax man? And I've been for 12 years, I've been the thorax man. But today we'll speak about pediatric radiology. That's what I do for a living every day, almost every day. So this will be two lectures in a row here, and we will speak about different topics in pediatric radiology. And that's, of course, this is a very big topic. We could talk about all these thick books about pediatric radiology. But we will speak about mainly four areas. And the first one is about urinary tract infections, because that's very common. That's something you will see in general practice when you're if you're the family physician or when you work in the hospital. Many children, they present with a urinary tract infection, or at least you suspect there might be a urinary tract infection. So that's one of them. And the other one is fractures, because if you work in the emergency, you get children every day with all kinds of fractures, or they have pain somewhere, and you wonder if there is a fracture. And the fractures in children, they're actually different from fractures in adults. So you need to know something about fractures in children. And then we have this very naughty thing here about child abuse. We have to speak about child abuse, because we know that you as a doctor might be the first to discover that something is wrong. You see that, well, this is not as it should be. These x-rays show something which is really suspicious. So you don't have to be into forensic medicine to be a detective and ask yourself, should this be investigated more? Because you might, as a doctor, be the first that get a thought that this is suspicious. So maybe we should do something more here. So we will speak much about that as well. After that, we will speak about congenital dysplasia of the hip. Because, as you know, that may be terrible for a child if we don't discover it, if it's not treated. These patients have huge hip problems later in life, but it's very simple to discover. It's very simple to examine with ultrasound, also with clinical examination. So we'll speak more about that. As you know, all newborn are tested now with the Ortolani to see if there is some suspicion about hip dysplasia. And at last, we will speak about those children with big heads. So first, urinary tract infections. Is it that common? Well, if you read the teach books, the school books will tell you that maybe 0.5% of all the boys will someday have urinary tract infection, or maybe 5% of the girls. But if you look more closely to it, if you see at the infants, it's actually the boys who have most infections in their urinary tract. So in some materials, they say approximately 2.5% or 2.7%, one material says that, but of the infant boys. But among the infant girls, it's only 0.7%. So that's very different from what you might have heard about the more toddlers and the more the older children, where it's a girl problem. I mean, in school age, it's quite opposite. It's 1.2% of school age girls in some materials show that they have a bacteria in their urine. But it's only 0.04% of the boys. So it might have to do with the long urethra, you might have heard, and that could be the reason for the older children, but we don't really know why these infants, why it's opposite with them. We don't really know, at least I don't know, but it's still statistics. Okay, so you should know something about this. And if you see what is the cause of urinary tract infections, the most common is colonic bacteria. It's E. coli, and when they're bored, they attack something. And if you have bacteria from the intestine coming on from the colon or the rectum here, and they might invade the urethra, go into the bladder, and when it's in the bladder, you might have an infection. And if it's only in the bladder, you have a lower urinary tract infection, a bladder infection. But of course, as you know, you have the ureter on each side, and these bacteria might ascend as well. They go upwards towards the kidneys, and you might have a more complicated infection when it's in the renal pelvis or in the renal parenchyma itself. You might have a higher in the upper urinary tract infection. So we won't speak very much about this because I think you have had something about this already from the pediatricians, but you know that it's colonization. That's not dangerous, but colonization might lead to infection, and infection might lead to ascension, and ascension to pyelonephritis, and you might even get acute kidney injury from the infection. So, how is it? Symptoms. The infants might have fever, diarrhea, or even sepsis, but it's very, very difficult to say that this has to be some kind of urinary tract infection. Because it's fever, diarrhea, well, could be anything, couldn't it? So you have to take the urine sample, you have to examine the urine, and it can't even tell that it's pert when they're peeing. But the toddlers, they might even have failure to thrive, but it's much the same, vomiting, diarrhea, might have fever. When you come to the 2 to 5 year olds, they might say, I have abdominal pain. And if you ask a child where its pain is, always around the umbilicus. You know, it's in the middle of the stomach because they can't tell the difference. But it could be urinary tract infection. So that's important to know. It could be constipation. It might be dysuria or urgency. They have to run to the toilet or they even pee their pants. And might be stinking, might not. But the symptoms are a bit different when compared to the smaller children. And the older children, they may have suprapubic discomfort. They can tell it's here. And they may have hematuria. They may have blood in their urine. And they might have flank pain if it's going upwards towards the kidney. So, but common line, however, often there are no specific symptoms. But you have to think about urinary tract infection. So, who needs imaging? Well, if a baby is less than 1 year old, I think if you have the guidelines today are that if they just have one time urinary tract infection, you should do something. Because you want to know, it's not that common. It could be something developmental, something that's wrong. So those children below the age of 1 with urinary tract infection, usually the pediatrician will do some imaging in the first place after the first infection. Is a boy or a girl, doesn't matter. But when you come to the older children, it's more that if it's a girl, it's more common. So we say that it has to be 3 infections or more. Then we should do some imaging to look at the kidneys, look at the bladder. For boys, we say once is enough. If you have one time urinary tract infection, something might be wrong, and we should do some imaging, some more investigations. When it comes to complicated urinary tract infections, of course, we have to do some imaging because we have the urine samples, we have the blood tests, but we don't know if there is something inborn, some display, something which is developmental wrong with that child or some structural fault with their kidneys. So then they come to the X-ray department. And what do? We have different tools in our toolbox. The most common is ultrasound. Ultrasound is easy, it's quite cheap, it doesn't have any ionizing radiation, no pain, but a lot of gain. So we do ultrasound a lot. Pediatric radiologists love ultrasound. We don't use CT almost at all due to the high dose of ionizing radiation. So we're very careful about dose because even regular X-ray, which we could think in an adult, would be quite okay with this dose. We think, okay, this child might be living for 80 or 90 years from now. They have very vulnerable cells. Their DNA is very vulnerable to ionizing radiation. We have to be really careful. And their cells are parting all. They are multiplying all the time. And it's dangerous for small children to have large doses of ionizing radiation. And as we told you in the thorax, in the chest X-ray course, you know that one CT might be 100 times the dose compared to one X-ray. So you have to be really careful. But we love ultrasound. And sometimes we have to do some special X-ray. And VCUG is one of those examinations. And we will talk more about that. It's avoiding cystourethrogram, where we actually put contrast medium into the bladder, and the bladder is actually voided. We empty the bladder, or the child empties the bladder during X-ray examination, so we can see if contrast is going or urine is going up with reflux to the kidneys. You will see some pictures of that. And of course, we have the MRI, which is the Rolls-Royce, which is really the most sophisticated examination. But of course, it's a problem because it might take half an hour, and these small toddlers, they cannot lie there for half an hour without general anesthesia. So that's very demanding when it comes to resources. And we have to have anesthesia doctors and nurses and everything. And it's all, and of course, even though the risk is today quite small with general anesthesia, it's really demanding when it comes to resources. So we are careful. We don't use MRI all the time on these small children. But of course, with those older children, MRI is a very good option when they can lie still. And sometimes we do, but it's demanding when it comes to resources, so we don't do that all the time. If we can do it with ultrasound or some other examination method, that's brilliant. And we have the urography. We don't do that very much anymore, but we used to do a lot of urography where we give contrast medium intravenously, and we then take X-ray pictures where we see that contrast is excreted through the urine in the kidneys, and we can follow the renal pelvis and the ureter down to each side. So these are the most common tools we use. So then you understand why I've not even taken a picture of a CT here, because we don't do it on a regular basis. It's just when we can't do anything else, we do a CT. So this is the working horse, is the ultrasound machine. I love to ride the ultrasound machine because that's what we do every day, all day long with children. And it's brilliant because you get real-time pictures, it's no radiation, no pain, and it's brilliant for visualizing the different organs, at least in the abdomen, and we get much information from these pictures. It's easy. And these small children, they might be quite lying still. Is actually not a problem. And if they're not lying still, we give them some sugar and they're happy. So usually we can do this quite easily. And if we put them around lying prone like this child, we get brilliant pictures of the kidneys. And we can measure the length of the kidneys, the size of the kidneys. Because in some urinary tract infections, upper urinary tract infections, the kidney might be bigger than normal. And we want to follow when it goes back to the normal size. And in some other diseases, the kidney on one side will not grow as fast as the other. And we can measure the kidney quite very accurate by just putting the child prone, the stomach down, and the probe on the back, and we get very good images. And we have these graphs. We can just go into the literature and see what is normal, and when we have this curve showing what is the normal size for different age groups. So renal size is quite easily measured with ultrasound. But you have to put them in prone position. I at least have to remind our residents about that. We don't do that with the adults, usually. But the children, it's a beautiful view when you turn them around. So now you know, even though the residents don't know. Okay, this is an ultrasound picture. And this is a CT. Sometimes we have to do a CT, but often we can do just an ultrasound. And this is a power Doppler ultrasound. All you see, this almost looks like a campfire. But it's not flames, it's not heat, it's flow. Ultrasound Doppler is to depict flow. When something moves, you get color. So this is actually the different vessels within the renal parenchyma that is actually moving within the kidney. And we can see that all these different areas are well are well perfused, but we have a small area here which is not well perfused, and that is the place of infection, because you have edema in that area. With the pyelonephritis, when there is nephritis, there is infection in the renal parenchyma. You have diminished perfusion in that area. And with Doppler, you could see that there is less perfusion in this part of the kidney. And that's the same we can see here with intravenous contrast medium. Given intravenously and taken CT pictures, we can see areas of the kidney with less perfusion. We even see some water or edema reaction around the kidneys, and we can see a lot of other details. So CT is beautiful when we take it. We have a lot of information, but if we can do just the ultrasound, we do. Here, this is an examination where we have given in contrast medium intravenously. And then we see on the urography, which is here, we have that you have, this is the renal pelvis on each side, but here you have something else. This might be that you have some congenital condition with, for instance, a duplex pelvis. You have duplex kidney. You have two pelvises. And you may have problems with flow out of the upper pelvis here, the upper part of the kidney. Because some patients actually have dual ureters and they have dual kidney pelvises. And very often you have problems with one of them, like here, the most apical one, the upper one, has a thicker ureter all the way down, and the ureter from the upper pole inserts here ectopically in another place, medial and caudal to the lower pole ureter, which is coming here, which is the normal ureter. And this part of the kidney may function quite normally, but this one has a problem, because you see that there is something is hindering the urine from going down into the bladder, and you even have a cystocele here. You have this, it's like this small fluid collection here, which is a small cyst by the ectopic ureter. So, and you have other conditions like this one, uretropelvic junction obstruction. It's very narrow here. It should be like this. This is the normal side on the right side. But on the left side, you see there is a narrowing at the bottom of the pelvis here, and therefore there is hydronephrosis. It's dilatation of the pelvis and the collecting system within the kidney. It could be like this, with a very tiny little opening here. And if we do, this could be operated, but it's important to have the right diagnostics prior to the operation. This is ultrasound, where you see that this is the renal pelvis on the patient's left side. You see it's from the back here. We have the probe here vertically on the back. And this is a dilated renal pelvis, and also the collecting system within the kidney itself is hugely dilated, because the urine is black. It's fluid and it's black when compared to the renal parenchyma, which is more gray here, and the subcutaneous fatty tissue here. Here's another example where we can just make measurements to see how much dilatation you have, how much dilation you have within the kidney, and also the size of the renal pelvis. And this patient even have huge ureters going down to the bladder, which is here. This is the bladder. This is an actual view. You see from below, you see that the probe is transversely on the lower part of the abdomen, and the picture is as though we see the patient from the foot side, and we see this is the bladder, and these are the huge ureters on each side here. It's really dilated, and that's because there is something here hindering the urine from coming into the bladder. So, what do we do? We want to have a look on the voiding. How do they pee? And we come to the VCUG, the peeing examination. And you could go on YouTube, because it's a lot of good patient information there. We could have a look at this video if it works. Usually it does.
Jamie Daly. I work at the University of Michigan Mons Children's Hospital. This book for you, so you know to, when you are having a test called VCUG. Your doctor wants you to have a test called VCUG. The test uses a special camera to take pictures, called x-rays, of your bladder and kidneys, the parts of your body that make and hold pee. On the day of the test, you will come to the hospital with your mom, dad, or another adult. You will go to the radiology department and sign in. When it's your turn, the technologist who takes the pictures will call your name. He or she will give you a gown and show you to the changing room. Take all your clothes off, even your underwear. The ties to the gown go in the back. The technologist will ask, when's your birthday? The technologist will show you into the x-ray room where the pictures will be taken. Only one adult can come with you. Who will you pick? In the x-ray room, there will be a big table to lie down on. Babies lie on a movable space table with Velcro to keep them snug and safe. The technologist will take your picture with the x-ray camera on the ceiling. You will be able to see the x-ray pictures on a TV screen. Be sure to smile. The technologist will wash your private area with special brown soap and put a tiny tube in where your pee comes out. A piece of tape on your leg will keep it from falling out. Your job during this time is to hold very still. The doctor will come in and move the table camera in place to begin the test. The camera comes close, but it will not touch you. Your parents can stand at the head of the table and hold your hands. Everyone but you has to wear a heavy protective apron because only your picture is being taken. If you look to the right, you will see a TV screen. You can watch your bladder fill up with the special water that looks dark on the TV screen. When your bladder is full, the doctor will ask you to roll a little to the left and then to the right to see the front and back of the kidneys and bladder. Your doctor will ask you to pee in a special towel or container and take pictures while you pee. Peeing is the most important part of the test. Don't worry, the tube is so tiny it won't be in the way. The trick is to relax and think of water flowing. Keep peeing until you are completely empty. When you have finished peeing, the test is done. Often the little tube in your bladder has already come out while you were peeing. The technologist will remove the tape from your leg. It will feel like taking off a bandage. Remind your parent to take off the heavy apron and get your clothes. It's time to go. Drink lots of fluid-like water or juice for the rest of the day. For more information about VCUG, visit www.umich.edu/careguides.
Yeah. That's how we do it. Remember to take off the apron. Here, we put the catheter into the penis, into the bladder. We fill up with contrast medium, and the bladder grows bigger and bigger and bigger, and you have to lie quite still. And when the child is voiding, we take some pictures. This could be a bit difficult for the children, so we have to entertain them sometimes. Sometimes you could wish you have ventriloquists with you, with these dolls, but they're so scary, these dolls, aren't they? Look at those eyes. So I've got my own ventriloquist dolls, we have, for instance, this one, the teddy bear doctor. Here, Here it is. So sometimes I have the teddy bear doctor with me into the lab. And once, sometimes I'm really quarreling with this teddy bear doctor. So I just, "Hi, you have to be quiet now."
"No, I won't be quiet because I love you. I will."
And he's yelling at me.
"No, you shouldn't do that.
"You be quiet. I'm working."
"You try working. I'm shelling. I'm yelling at you."
See, and I was, "Oh, what?" And I have to quiet him down all the time. And the children just look at this, the teddy bear. So once I had this boy, he was 8 years old. And I was quarreling with this teddy bear the whole examination. While we put the catheter into his penis, I was quarreling with the teddy bear. And the teddy bear demanded to sit upon the x-ray tube. And I know you can't do that.
"I will sit here. I will sit here. I will sit here."
And he was there all the time. And I was yelling at him, "You could do that." And the boy was really just looking. And he just forgot everything around him. And suddenly, the whole examination was over. And the technician asks the boy, he was a bit old to do this examination. I mean, you're 8, it's not that fun to have this catheter put into your penis and all that stuff. So the technician said, "Wasn't that a strange doctor?" "No, not the doctor, but the teddy bear." I was serious all the time, you know. The teddy bear was crazy. So you can do that. So if you become a pediatrician or a pediatric radiologist, you can play with all these stuffed animals, you know. So this one is in my pockets much of the time. It's Tigger. It's a tiger. Yeah. So when I do the ultrasound, Tigger goes around and, "Hello, hello, hello." And I'm sitting there all serious. "Hey, no, be quiet."
"Oh, hello, hello, here I am, hello."
And he goes around the table and looks at the children. It's really funny to be a pediatric radiologist. And I have this one as well. Here. It's so cute, isn't it?
"Hello, hello, hello."
I actually found this book about ventriloquism from Denmark. So I have, so I can train to speak without the children seeing me moving my lips. So that should be part of the curriculum, I think. But they can sit here. There. Tigger. Yeah. In the lab. And this is a fluoroscopy lab. And there you actually have Winnie the Pooh, you have Piglet, you have Tigger, we have them all. So it should be fun. It should be a good experience to come to the x-ray department. And the children love it. Should be like that. Shouldn't be scary. So at least we have to. Why scare them? Okay. It's a big patient this time. But it lies down. Have this catheter into the urethra and into the bladder. And here we see. We start to fill the bladder. More and more contrast. And suddenly, contrast is going upwards on the left side, into the ureter on the left side. This is not normal. Before the child pees. And here we have another one, where we fill the bladder like this. And then it's emptied. And it's normal, because it empties in a normal way, and nothing goes up. There is no reflux here. So that's normal. The urine shouldn't go up to the kidneys. It should just go down. But when it doesn't, it might be like this. This is from the side you remember from the video, that the child should go to the left side and to the right side. And here is turned to the right side, and we see the urethra going down here. This is a boy, obviously. And you have the bladder here, and you see the ureter all the way up, and even a dilated pelvis, and this dilation of the collecting system within the kidney. Or like this, bilaterally, reflux on each side, and you see both collecting systems here. And we have a system, like the Fehrenbach and Feinstein system. We could grade the reflux. Sometimes it's just going up the ureter. Sometimes it's just barely filling the pelvis and the collecting system. Sometimes it's really dilating the ureter and the collecting system. And you have different degrees when it comes to this tumescent really, it's really filled up and it's harsh to see. Here's another one. You have just a little bit of reflux. It's a first degree. Here. Here's another one. It's not much to see. But the renal pelvis is dysplastic. We don't see that here, but we see a diverticula here. A diverticulum here, and maybe a little one here, which is this small sac on the side of the bladder here, which is filled with contrast. This is another one. It's degree 2 to 3. It's not that easy to see. Here's another one. It's reflux 3rd degree here on the left side, going up, and we see that the renal pelvis is filled like this, here. And this one, huge, both sides, both kidneys, both pelvises, really dilated. So this is a really good examination to see the degree of reflux and the degree of dilation of the collecting system. And that's important for the pediatricians and the surgeons when they decide the type of, if they're just waiting and see, or if they're doing some surgery, or what they do with these patients. It's important to know the degree of reflux. Then we have to speak about the sad side, about child abuse. Because unfortunately, we see child abuse several times every year, and maybe we see it much more often than we actually want to know. And in many cases, we as health personnel, as nurses, technicians, and doctors, we might be the only one who could understand what is actually happening here. And we could save children, even both from death and from abuse, if we do the right things at the right time. We should be very concerned if there are trauma and fractures that we cannot explain. I mean, it's not always so that the parents have seen everything that happened, but if they cannot explain, if this is really suspicious, this doesn't smell well, maybe you should do something more and examine if there could be something criminal happening here. Or if there are unexplained fractures, if there are strange fractures, fractures that usually don't appear in these age groups, you should be alarmed. Especially if you have long bone fractures in children below the age of 18 months, when they're not walking themselves and they're just in the cradle or they're carried around, it's very difficult to have long bone fractures. Examinations have been done research on this, and you can look in one of the papers. I've given you 5 papers on the web, and I've highlighted everything important, so you shouldn't be scared. So, and you have a lot of good images there and some statistics as well about child abuse. And some of these injuries are very specific for child abuse, and you should know about them. So I would encourage you to read through the most important parts of the paper, at least which is highlighted in yellow, and read under the figures, the legends below the figures, so that you learn about this. There is a specific syndrome. We call it the battered child syndrome. You might have heard about the shaken baby syndrome. Those are almost synonyms. It has to do with the type of injury that is inflicted on these small children when people shake them vigorously. And we can understand that some parents who are really, really tired and they're really, really scared and everything, and they just lose control and they shake the baby. But that's really, really, really dangerous. Because the acceleration and the deceleration of this tiny little body, when it's held with adult hands, it's very dangerous for their bodies. So they get traumatic brain injuries, they get rib fractures, which are very specific for this type of injury, as you will see. And they get a special kind of fractures, which is metaphyseal corner fractures, or what we call bucket handle fractures. And these fractures are typically associated with child abuse. You don't get them from just falling out of the crib or out of the bed or something like that. You shouldn't read all the text. It's just, I want to teach you about the Radiology Assistant. It's a very good website. It's not too complicated even for medical students like you. Radiologyassistant.nl. It's in Netherlands, but it's in the Netherlands, but it's all in English. It's a beautiful website. And this is just one of the samples from that web page about the CNS injury, which shows that it's the shaking of the head. I remember one of the professors when I studied medicine, he said about babies, it's a big head dragging around with a little body. And yes, he was right. It's a big head dragging around with a body. And if you just hold the body and you shake the body, the acceleration and the deceleration of the head, is you want to think about it. It's huge. So it's very easy to damage the central nervous system, the brain, and get hemorrhages and even parenchyma injury to the brain. This is a picture from an American article where we have a pathology specimen here from a child that died from shaking. And you see these big blood clots here in the midsection of the brain between the hemispheres around the cortex here. And you have this illustration showing how blood is filling the area between the dura and the other membranes here. And this is because you have these tiny, small bridging vessels that go from the cerebral parenchyma to the skull. And when the heavy brain is accelerated and decelerated, these vessels tear and you get these hemorrhages. And you can see it on CT here. You have blood between the two hemispheres. And even here you have blood between the cerebellum and the larger brain. This is the typical rib fracture that happens when babies are shaken. Because the hand is holding the chest, you get these very medial fractures here, close to the sternum on the front, and close to the vertebral column on the right, on the dorsal side. And you even get some fractures here laterally because the chest is compressed. And of course, these fingers and these hands are all too strong for this rib cage. So you get these typical fractures like that. This is a pathologic specimen from a child who died. And you see all the fractures here, close to the vertebral column here, all the way up. You have these fractures all the way. And this is specimen microscopy, where you see that there is a fracture line through the cortex and through the bone here. And this is an X-ray, where you have the fracture here. And you might see them on a regular X-ray as well, but they're not easy to see. But after some days and weeks, you get callus formation. There is calcifications around the fractures, and then it's more easy to see. In the acute phase, rib fractures might, as you remember from the chest X-ray course, very difficult to see, at least if they're not dislocated. But after a while, when it grows, they start to calcify, you get callus formation around the fracture, and then it's more easy to see. And what should really raise your concern is if you see fractures of different ages in the same child. Of course, there are some who have diseases that make them disposed for fractures, so you have to be very careful. Just don't you can't just say at once that this has to be some kind of abuse. You have to know that there is no syndrome, some other disease that make their the skeletal system very brittle for fractures. But you have to be very careful And you there should ring some alarm bells if you see these fractures. You have to do more examinations. They should be referred to the pediatric department, and the pediatricians there work in close collaboration with the police about these things. Do all the necessary investigations. This is just another sample where you see the fractures here and here. Now, this is an example that actually the costochondral transition area between the bony area and the chondral area of the costa, of the rib. This is also a place for fracture in these children. Then it comes to the long bone fractures. I told you initially that if you see spiral fractures or fractures in the long bones, at least when they're less than 18 months, you should be concerned. This is normally not possible without some kind of abuse or direct trauma. But there are some really specific fractures, and we call them corner fractures. These are the corner of the long bones are ripped off like this. You just see a tiny little fracture line here. And these come from this shaking, from this shaking. And it tears off because the ligaments and everything that are connected to the bones, and these are the weakest areas are ripped off. And these are not easy to see. But as pediatric radiologists, we are trained, we should be at least trained to look for them. The most important thing is that you ask for advice if you think this could be some abuse case. And you speak to the pediatrician, and the pediatrician, they speak to us, and we take the necessary examinations. So when we are concerned, we actually take x-ray of the whole body. We take x-rays of the whole body to look for these specific fractures. And you have the other one, which is called bucket handle fractures. You know, if you have a bucket with a handle, it's like that. You have the handle, you could turn it up and down. This looks like a bucket handle here. This actually is very related to the corner fracture, but it goes all the way around. They're most common in the tibia and the femur, proximal, humerus, and frequently bilateral, because when a child is shaken, both sides are affected. This is the bucket handle fracture. This is the corner fracture. Specimen here, x-ray here. Here, corner fracture, corner fracture, corner fracture. Then we're going to speak about the regular, innocent fractures from children doing all kind of crazy things, and it's all, it's fun stuff, like jumping on a trampoline or shooting with a bow and arrow or anything. When I was a kid, we were allowed to do anything. I mean, we got sharp knives from, we could hold a knife, and I got bow and arrow, and even air guns, and everything when I was a child. So today I found this old video clip of myself. It was not a video at the time, it was a film clip. When I got my first arrow and bow from my father, and he filmed me. So it could be really hurting my little brother, but this is what happened. This is me. This is my little brother, and that's my mother. Oh, I shot at the side of him. Oh, once more. And there is mom watching, and my dad is filming. This is so cool. Yeah. The land of the free. Yeah. So if you didn't see it, I'll show you. It's not very safe. Here comes little brother. First shot, didn't hit. Mom, relax. Almost hitting the head. So I remember being in the forest with my dad, got my own knife. I cut myself several times, didn't get any tendon injuries. Luckily, I got this big Sami knife. I don't know how old I was, but cut my fingers several times. But I remember being with my dad in the forest in the springtime, making willow flutes. You done that? Yeah, that's cool. If you don't know how, I've got this small, here, instruction. Yeah. We're making a willow flute. And the whole point with a willow flute is that the bark, the cortex, is so strong. At the same time, it's so elastic. So you could just, you make this, you take this rod of the tree and you cut it around and you hit it with the, yes, with the knife. You've done that in your country as well, yes. And then you turn it off because it's soft, but it's strong, and you take it off and you can make this flute. And that's very comparable to the skeleton of the small child, because the cortex of the bone is just like the cortex of the willow or any other of these soft trees. So that when you fracture the bone of a small child or bigger child as well, before they get into puberty, it's soft but at the same time strong. So we don't get the same fractures as with adults usually. With adults, it's brittle. It's just, and it's just like breaking something dry into two pieces. But with the small children, you have this cortex around, which is really soft, at the same time strong. So you could get different kinds of fractures. And one of them is called the torus fracture, or the buccal fracture. What's a buccal fracture? If you take the one I was using to make my willow flute, and you just turn it over that way, it wouldn't break because the cortex is so strong. But you will get a buckle on the short side because it buckles. That's a torus fracture. And you get it on the side here. So if the force is this way, you get it on the inside. But if you get both the torus on this side and the cortex actually tears open, then you get what we call a green stick fracture. A green stick fracture. And that's when the cortex is broken on the others, on the outer side of the fracture. So these are the most common fractures. For instance, in the radius of children, you very seldomly see that the whole bone is broken off. It's usually a torus or a green stick fracture due to this elastic but at the same time strong cortex around the bone. So this is what you see. But there is some other you have to think about with children, because they have a growth plate. This is, as you've learned in physiology, this is where all the growing appears in the long bones. You have chondrocytes and osteoblasts and osteoclasts and all this histology going on there. But this is actually the weakest zone. So if you have forces on each side of the growth plate usually breaks before the bone. That's the reason for epiphyseolysis, which is common in children. And in connection with epiphyseolysis, where the epiphysis, the upper part of the body, the distal part, moves because the growth plate is broken, you might have fracture in addition. And those are different types of epiphyseolysis fractures, which we'll see in a minute. What is this? This is a buccal fracture. This is the tibia. The force has been this way, and you get the buccal on the inside. And when you see it from the side view, you have it on the back here, and it's on the medial side here, and the dorsal side here. You have this buccal on the side of the bone. But it's not broken off. And these heal very good. They heal quickly in these children. And they need a plaster cast or some cast just to keep it still during growth, but often they are fine in 3 weeks or something like that. This is also a buccal fracture, but it's in the radius, the distal forearm, the radius, the most common fracture when you fall on one arm. Because you get the forces here, you break the distal radius dorsally, and you get the buckle on the side here, on the upper side. Because you break it up like that, you get the buckle on the dorsal side. In the grown-up, you will get the collis fracture. You break it off, you get the dorsal dislocation, which is 90% of the cases, while the Smith fracture is 10% of the fracture, because very seldomly you fall like that. That's the Smith fracture. This is a collis fracture. But the equivalent to the collis fracture in the child is buckle or green stick fracture in the distal radius with a buckle on the dorsal side. Here, you have a green stick fracture in the middle part of the forearm. You see both bones, this is antebrachium fractures. This is a forearm fracture where both radius and ulna are broken. And because you can see there is a fracture line here, it's opened up. This is not a buccal fracture, this is a green stick fracture. If you take the willow stick and you break it, and the cortex breaks off on the outer side, and it opens up and you get this fracture into the bone, but it's still intact on the opposite side. That is the green stick fracture. This is a picture of the hand, and this is the thumb. And it's not that easy to see, but if you see the epiphysis of the first metacarpal bone, it is dislocated towards the ulnar side here. This is the epiphysiolysis. It's broken here in the growth line, in the growth plate, and it's just a little ulnar dislocated. And we have the different kinds of epiphysiolysis fractures, and the system made by Salter, Harris. You have five types. Type one is just the growth zone. No fracture, just the growth zone. Type two, which is the most common one, you're looking at the most common type. I'm so cool, he says. It's in the growth plate and up into the diaphysis, the metaphysis here, just below the growth zone. Type three is not very common. It's a part of the growth plate and out into the distal part of the epiphysis, through the growth plate and the epiphysis. Type four is not even common. It's both the epiphysis, the growth plate, and the metaphysis all the way through. And type five is the crash, where the growth plate is just stamped together. It's in the longitudinal direction. It's compressed together. But this is the most common type. And you have this type, where you don't have any fracture at all. But you can see this many times. You have the type 2 Salter-Harris fracture in children. So you can look for that. Maybe the growth plate is a bit dislocated. Many times, the only thing we see is the small fracture going up on the proximal side of the growth plate, where the little corner is teared off. It's not like the corner fracture we spoke about last time, but it's in relation to the growth plate. You have this small, tiny fragment is broken off. The whole thing is just to think that fractures look different in children. So you don't always see this fracture line going all the way through. You have to look for displacement because the growth plate may have moved. And you may look for small, tiny changes such as a buckle or a green stick fracture. This is a large epiphysiolysis because it's in the femoral head. The whole upper part, the epiphysis of the femoral head itself, is dislocated by a trauma. And this has to be repositioned and fastened by the orthopedic surgeon when it's gone far away from its original place. Here you see it. It doesn't look very nice, does it? This is the growth plate. And the distal part is completely dislocated in relation to the femoral head above the growth plates. Then we have some diseases like the leg Calvert-Pertes disease, which is actually a circulatory problem in the head of the femur. You have, as you know, these epiphyseal arteries that go into the head of the femur. And if you get a circulation problem here, you might get necrosis. And that is what is happening. You have a circulation problem in the head of the femur. So this one looks quite normal, both the left side and the right side, because it's early in the progress of the Calvert-Pertes disease. You don't see anything on regular X-ray. But we did an MRI. And there we see a normal epiphysis on the right side, but on the left side it's completely black on this sequence. And still you don't see anything on regular X-ray because the structure has not moved. The skeletal structure is still there, but it's not circulated. I mean, it's a circulation problem. The calcification of the bone is still there. But something will happen. It will happen in future here because you don't have circulation and the head of the femur will eventually die or is dead. This is after 6 months and you see a big difference between the right fine rounded shape of the femur, of the femoral head, and the left one, which is starting to flatten down here. And if we follow this patient after 10 months, it's really flat and not a very good joint. And after even longer time, like 16 months, it's really sclerotic. It's distorted. And the whole joint is destroyed. And this is after 3 years. So in some cases, we need an MRI or some more advanced examination to see what the diagnosis actually is. But after a while, it becomes very visible also on regular X-ray. Any questions about skeletal trauma? We could say more about this, but this is about the common fractures and the common normal skeletal traumas and diseases in children. Questions about fractures? Or... yeah? Oh, for Calvert-Pertes?
Yeah, this hip on the spine. What is the treatment of
weight? If the whole joint is destroyed, the treatment would be hip replacement with an implant.
Until the child is grown up?
Yeah, when you need to have one, yes. It's a decision made by the surgeon when it's possible, but yes. Hip replacement. And then you have the developmental dysplasia of hip. Have you had any lecture about that from the pediatricians? Yeah? So they told you a little about ultrasound, maybe, and the ortolani? Yeah? In the old days, I remember when I was a kid and shooting with arrows and stuff, some older people couldn't walk due to dysplasia of the hip, and they were not treated as children. Today, people with congenital dysplasia of the hip are discovered early, simple treatment, and we have almost no problems on the long run due to dysplasia of the hip. But in less developed countries, this is, of course, a huge problem if it's not discovered. And these people, these patients, have huge disability. But it's very simple to treat, and it's very quite simple to diagnose. We have to know something about the anatomy and the mechanics of the hip joint. This is the pelvic bone, and you have the acetabulum here, the acetabular cavity, and this is the femoral head into the joint here. And of course, for this joint to function, the as the tabular part here has to be deep enough to cover the joints, the femoral head in a good way. If it's too shallow or the femoral head comes too far out, it will not be stable. And that is the problem of dysplasia of the hip. So we want to see on these infants if the joint is stable or if it can be dislocated. And we want to see with imaging how is the acetabulum, how does it look. And this is how we do it. After the pediatrician has done his or her ortolani or some other test where they have some suspicion that this might be dysplasia, or you have a first degree relative like the mother or the father or a brother or a sister with known hip dysplasia, we always do ultrasound. And even if children go to the public health nurse and the public health nurse finds some irregularity, extra skin folds or something is strange, the risk of dysplasia is very low, but we take them in and we do ultrasound because it's cheap, it's quick, and we can check very easily if the child has hip dysplasia. So sometimes we get them also from the GPs and the public health nurses to look for dysplasia. But the most common is during the first week, during the first day when they're in the hospital, and the pediatrician wonders if this could be some kind of dysplasia because they're unsure about the ortolani result. They come up to the X-ray department and we just easily do this ultrasound to check if there is signs of dysplasia or immature hips. So we have this cradle here where the child lies down, and we turn the child over to the side like this. And then we take off the diapers and start the ultrasound machine, and we put the probe here just over the hip joint on the side. So we first look at the right side, and then we look at the left side. And because we have the probe here, we can get a very detailed picture of the hip joint. And this is how you see it on the screen. This is the femoral head. And this is acetabulum. This is the pelvic bone. And this is not a very newborn. It's a bit older, as you saw, the child was a bit older. So this is a growth. This is how the femoral head is growing from inside. And you have the acetabulum here. And as you see, it's a deep and good and normal looking acetabulum, because when it's normal, more than 50% of the head is inside the acetabulum. If less than 50% is inside, it could be less mature or even a small degree of dysplasia. And we see here that this patient has much less than 50% inside, and this one is all the way outside the acetabulum. Different degrees of dysplasia. And we'll look at the angle of the roof of the acetabulum, because the child is on the side, so this is actually the roof. You see the child lies like this, and when the child lies on the side, this is towards the head, and this is towards the feet. So this is the weight-bearing portion of the acetabulum. So if this one is too steep, the femoral head might go out of the joint. So we measure the angle here, which should be 55 to 60 degrees or more. And if it is more than 60 degrees, it's completely normal. And sometimes we see that it's just immature. It's not dysplasia, but it's immature. So we take them back after some weeks, make a new ultrasound. And if it's still very immature and we suspect that there might be some degree of dysplasia, the child is treated with this cushion between his or her legs for some weeks and months. And it usually always normalizes with this treatment. So in this case, we see that the left is completely normal. You have 60 degrees here, but on the right side, it's much less. Maybe it's just 45 degrees. And we see that on the left side, the femoral head is inside the acetabulum, more than 50%, but on the right side, much less than 50% is inside the joint here. It's a bit tricky to learn because you have to, I'm joking, it's like drinking a cup of coffee in the alpine downhill skiing because it's the child is moving all the time and you're trying to get all these angles correct and you have to follow the movements of the child and it can be really tricky sometimes. I know some of the residents are really struggling with learning this, but when you just have learned it, it's not that difficult. And if it's really difficult, we get them some sugar water and the child just, it's almost like general anesthesia because they've never tasted anything as sweet as this. So they just go into coma and just... So we have this really strong sugar solution. So they get this on the pacifier. Or if they don't have a pacifier, they can use the finger of... Mom's finger is beautiful as well, dipped into sugar solution. And then... just disappears into another world and we can do the examination. But we have to be careful and not show that to any mother because maybe those who don't have that much resources maybe would try that at home. Don't do this at home. Yeah. Or we could take an x-ray. When the children are less than 4 months, it's good to do ultrasound. For those 4, 5, 6 months and older, we do x-ray because ultrasound is more difficult to see the joint well, and we also have more mature skeleton, and we can use x-ray, which is then the best examination, where we can measure the declination of the acetabulum, what we call acetabular index. We make a line here through, this is the open area where you just have cartilage between the bones. We call it the triangular cartilage. So when you have the right angle of the picture, you can see through here and you can draw this line and we measure the acetabular index. And we have diagrams where we can check the correct acetabular index for the different ages. And in this case, you have a good low inclination here, which makes it easy for the joint to keep the femoral head inside the joint. But on the left side, you have a very steep inclination. You have higher value of the acetabular index. You see the angle is much steeper. And then it's easier for the femoral head to pop out of the joint. And we also see that the center of the head here is more central inside the joint, but here is more laterally dislocated. So it might be subluxation. So here you have a dysplasia on the left side and it's normal on the right side. Here you have a normal hip on the left side, but it's dysplasia on the right side. It's more steep angle, and you see that the head of the femur is also less mature on the right side. Here's another one with dysplasia on the right side where we measure 40 degrees. And on the left side, it's slightly less than 33 degrees, which is normal for the age. So x-ray is a very good examination to look for dysplasia in these older babies. Here's another one. This is really dysplasia after some time, where you see that this was not discovered in time. So you have a much more mature skeleton where the left hip joint is actually really dysplastic and the femoral head is outside, much outside the acetabulum here. And these children get problems when they grow up. And still hip replacement for adults. Dysplasia is still one of the main causes for those younger patients getting hip replacement. A dysplasia or congenital dysplasia is one of the main reasons. But those are treated early and they usually normalize completely with just this cushion treatment, where they lie with their feet to the sides and the cushion between their legs. So, to summarize, below 4 months we use ultrasound and above 4 months we use x-ray. It's not strict 4 months, but approximately. Smaller babies, ultrasound. Bigger babies, x-ray. Questions about dysplasia? Yeah. If it's always the same. No, it is an acetabular problem because we speak about an immature acetabulum or a too shallow acetabulum, not deep enough. You have other diseases like cavaleg pertes and other diseases that might affect the femoral head. But when we speak about the congenital dysplasia of the hip, it's a problem with the acetabulum itself. Yeah, good question. No more? Go further? Yeah. Transient synovitis of the hip, what's that? Some children, they come leaping and going like this into the doctor's office, and they have not any broken bones, nothing, but they have some pain in one of the legs. And often it's difficult for small children to tell if it's the hip or if it's the knee or what it is. But they say futon. It's some place here in the left side or the right side. It's difficult. And you see that they're leaping and they have a problem with their gait. And you might take some x-rays because you want to know if this is a fracture, but you don't find any fracture. And it could be a transient synovitis of the hip. This is typically in those who are between 2 and 8 years old. And they will not put weight on the hurting foot. They might be subfebrile, they might have a little temperature, not very high, but they might have some temperature. But otherwise, they're healthy, but they won't use their foot. And if you examine this with imaging, you will find that they have increased fluid in the hip joint. If you see here, this is the cartilage area within the acetabulum. This is the femoral head. But the joint capsule goes all the way out here. It's a you have the membrane around the joint here, and you have increased fluid within the joint. And this could be, for instance, a reaction to an infection, viral infection, for instance. So often we don't know what was the reason. We suspect it could be some kind of viral infection. It could be some immune reaction to some virus or other cause. But what we find is that when we examine these children, they have increased fluid in the hip joint. And again, ultrasound is the imaging modality of choice because it's very easy. Just lie prone on their back, just lie supine on their back. You put the probe over the hip joint on the right side and the left side, and you compare. And if you see on one side that there is much fluid here, there is more fluid than the other side, you can guess that this is a transient synovitis of the hip. Of course, it could be bacterial synovitis. That's something very different. If you have a septic arthritis with bacteria within the joint, but those patients are sick. They don't just have a little temperature, just not limping a little. They're sick. And those few patients, septic with septicemia or other cause that has caused them to get infection within the joint, they have to be treated as emergency really, really quick. And it could look like this on ultrasound. Sometimes we might see that the fluid is not as clear. It could look a little more echogenic, a little grayer due to the bacteria and the pus within the joint, but we cannot always tell the difference. That is a clinical evaluation. You have to evaluate the whole patient. If this is a really sick patient where there is a reason to believe that there could be bacteria within the joint, and those have to be opened and eradicated and removed to clean the joint and start with antibiotics. But these patients are not that sick. They just won't walk on their leg. And we see that there is more fluid on one side. And if you're in doubt, you always have the other side to compare. This is the right side where it's completely normal. And this is the left side, just a little fluid here. That's typical. Wouldn't be so easy if you don't have the, but they, if you don't have the other side for comparison, but you always have. That's the beautiful thing. So you can always look at the other side and compare. Then we want to speak about those big-headed children, because they cause a lot of headache. Many parents are concerned, many public health nurses are concerned, many GPs are concerned when children have big heads. And of course, some children with big heads have big problems, like hydrocephalus. There could be some serious disease within the head. But the majority of those who present with a bigger head than usual are not sick, but some of them are. So how do we separate the sick from the healthy ones? Okay, then we have some consideration. It could be two reasons for hydrocephalus, because that's the one thing we want to disclose. We want to be sure that the child does not have hydrocephalus. What is hydrocephalus? It's enlargement of the ventricles and the CSF rooms within the brain. And we can see on imaging that the ventricles are large due to increased volume. And of course, there could be two main reasons for the increased volume. The one is obstruction. If you have an aqueduct stenosis, which hinders the circulation, because you know the CSF is circulating from the brain down the spine and up again, and it's circulating around. And if this one is stenotic, if there is a hindering here in the circulation, you get hydrocephalus due to obstruction. And the ventricles will enlarge, and you get hydrocephalus. The other possibility, of course, is that there is communication, but there is malresorption, so that the brain is not able to resorb enough cerebrospinal fluid. So those are the two possibilities. And we can do ultrasound again. It's so beautiful. These small babies, they have the fontanelle here. One here and one father back, and even one here behind the ears, where you can put the ultrasound transducers, and it's an opening where it's not bony, where you have this window into the brain. So the best imaging method for the newborn is actually ultrasound. And as you see here, we get beautiful pictures of the brain in the newborn. And today I had one child who was actually more than 6 months. He was referred with a big head. And the public health nurse or some other health person was concerned about the big head. And we can just put the probe on the head. And it was happily, the fontanelle was still open, so I could get a good view inside the brain. And I could see that the ventricles were not enlarged. And the room around the brain was not enlarged either, between the cortex and the skull. So this was just some child with a bigger head than some other child. But we could see an ultrasound here that the ventricles are huge. They are large. And we have papers, we have scientific papers, where we can go in and see on the diagrams how large should the ventricles be. How close should the right and left hemisphere be from each other in the frontal plane when you see it from the front? Because you get very good images when you just put the probe on the head and you scan back and forth through the brain. And you can do very standardized measurements of the ventricular system. So ultrasound is beautiful. We do that in the intensive care unit for the newborns as well and the premature children. We follow them often with several ultrasounds of the brain every week, because the premature children, I mean those who are born in 24th, 25th week or even earlier, many of those have cerebral hemorrhages, and we can see those very beautifully with ultrasound. I mean, those brains are small. The whole child might be 500 grams or something like that. And the brain is really small. But with ultrasound, we get beautiful images of the whole brain. So here we see that it's enlarged. And we can use other modalities as well, because if the child is too old for an ultrasound because the fontanelle is closed and you don't have the view, you might do an MRI. Magnetic resonance imaging is beautiful. We do that with a lot of children. But as I said, it's resource demanding because the child needs to lie quite still for maybe a half an hour or more. And if it's 10 or 12 years, that's okay. They can watch a movie even in one of our MRI machines. But for those small children, they cannot lie still for that long time, so they have to be in general anesthesia. But we get very good images of the brain, not only to see the size of the ventricles, but we can have all tiny small structures all over the brain to look for tumors, to look for how mature the white matter is compared to what is normal, and we can do all kinds of evaluations of the brain parenchyma. That MRI is the modality of choice. It's much better than CT for most things. But of course, CT is really fast. You can make a scan of the whole brain in 1 second, but the radiation dose is high. So we only use CT in those emergency situations where we have to see really quick if there is a hemorrhage due to trauma, like a motor vehicle accident or something like that. So usually we don't use CT, but we do MRI several times a week, and some days we have even two or three patients with general anesthesia in the MRI machine, pediatric patients. So here we can measure it. We can also look at the parenchyma. We have many sequences. We take many different pictures. I will not say much about that, but MRI can give us beautiful pictures showing all kinds of pathology. This is a patient which does not have hydrocephalus because the ventricular system is not enlarged, but it's just the subarachnoid spaces which are large. And we don't know the reason, so we call it idiopathic. That's what we say when we don't know. It's idiopathic. And it's quite usual. Well, those who have it is during the first year of life. The subarachnoid space is enlarged and therefore also the head size. But often these patients have family history of big heads. And if a child presents with a big head and you speak to the mother and father and both have big heads, well, it might be a reason. And it could be that even though the father doesn't have a very big head today, he had as a child. This is genetics. So many of those who present with a big head is just inherited from their parents. And it doesn't have to be any pathology at all. Like the benign, as it says, benign. It's not bad. It's okay. It's benign enlarged subarachnoid spaces. And we can see on ultrasound that there is a larger space here between the hemispheres. And there is enlarged fluid spaces with CSF outside the cortex under the skull here. This is under the fontanelle. But we see that there are vessels going through the fluid. If this was a hemorrhage, you wouldn't see vessels going through it. When we do Doppler, we see that vessels go through it. We know that this is just cerebrospinal fluid. And we can see on ultrasound that the ventricular system is not enlarged. This is a benign enlargement of the subarachnoid space. And we could do an MRI, and we see that the ventricular system has a normal size. We don't see anything wrong in the rest of the brain, but we see enlarged subarachnoid space. And this is not dangerous. It's okay. But there has been a debate because recently, the Norwegian government has changed the procedure for how the public health nurses should measure the head size of babies. We used to have a Norwegian material used in Norway from the Bergen studies, where they measured thousands of babies in Bergen, and they followed them, and they have a great material of Norwegian babies. How big are their heads? And that was used until recently. But now we're so international, so we have decided to use the WHO numbers. And then there is not Norwegian children, but there are also children from Somalia, and children from China, and children from Thailand, and children from Mexico. Of course, there are many more children than the Bergen examinations, but they're not Norwegian. And for some reason, Norwegian babies have bigger heads than the rest of the world. So, what happens? Many, many normal kids now go outside the normal curve. The parents are scared, public health nurse may be scared, and they're referred to the hospital. So this was one article in this medical paper written by some people you may know in this house about this problem. So it's necessary to have some knowledge, not only to follow the guidelines every time, because maybe it shouldn't be necessary to send all these patients with a little bigger head than the curve to the hospital.